And welcome, everyone. It's Wednesday evening here in America. Early Thursday morning in Ireland, Scotland, and UK, and elsewhere in Europe. I'm Stephen Roberts, and this is Cancel the Cabal on People's Internet Radio. Thanks, everyone, for sticking around after Sean's show. Whoever's going to stick around, I have a couple of very special guests on tonight. First is her first time on any kind of radio or television or anything like that. I have an author. Her name is Suzanne Still. Welcome to the show, Suzanne.
Thank you, Steve.
And I have a friend of hers, Greg Ford. Everybody knows Greg. So welcome back to the show, Greg.
Thank you, Steve. Hey, you know, by now, I've been on your show so many times, all your listeners can start calling me Uncle Greg.
Yeah. Uncle Greg, something like that. I guess we're going to talk about all kinds of political turmoil and upheaval around South America, Mexico, and all around the world, aren't we, Greg and Suzanne?
Yes, we are.
First, I guess we can get into a little bit of the books that you've authored, and I can find these up on Amazon and pop them in the chat room while we're doing that. The first one I know is called Commune of Women. Would you like to explain a little bit about this one?
Yes. Commune of Women is my first book. It is a novel, and it concerns a terrorist attack at L.A. International Airport. And in the commotion of the attack, six women are locked into a very small room where they have to stay for 4 days until they're rescued. And during that time, of course, they have to survive. Number one, and number two, they decide that they will tell their life stories to pass the time, basically, and to get to know one another. And they start with somewhat superficial, kind of funny stories, and as the days go by, the stories get deeper and darker and go much deeper into their life's secrets and mysteries. There is also a political aspect to it in that I really wanted to explore the whole phenomenon of terrorism and to really question who are the terrorists, because my suspicion is that there are major governments who are funding terrorism and that sometimes the terrorists themselves might actually be victims. So I
Absolutely.
Bring that question up.
Yeah, that's as Greg happened to mention on the last show, and we mentioned a lot on air. The many, many hundreds and hundreds of these radio shows and stuff, we know what a false flag terror attack is.
Right.
That's where, it doesn't necessarily have to be a government, because they train military officers that are in special positions how to do that themselves. If they're being attacked by someone, they just somehow attack themselves and blame it on somebody else.
I read a very interesting article recently that suggested that terrorist groups are now becoming sort of like soccer teams. They're funded by governments or, you know, special interest groups, and the media is presenting them to us as they're always going to be here, they're always going to be playing off against one another, so get used to it. And in the meantime, the military-industrial complex is reaping enormous benefits by supplying one side or the other, or both sides against one another.
Absolutely. I forgot to ask, and I forgot to mention, you are a doctor. What are you a doctor of?
A doctor of? I am a doctor of depth psychology.
Oh, that sounds very interesting there.
It is very interesting. Depth psychology is basically the psychology of the unconscious. You can think of Sigmund Freud and Carl Jung as the progenitors of the field of depth psychology. And it deals with all the phenomena of the unconscious, including dreams, which are my particular forte in life. I run dream workshops, and in my books you'll find dreams used as a way to move the plot forward.
I see. Okay. Yeah, that's maybe interpret your dreams. Is that what it is?
Interpretation of dreams, yeah, basically. Yeah. But that's not the entire field of depth psychology, but that's certainly okay. the area that is most
sure.
interesting to me.
Well, let's get into these books here. And the political ramifications, or the political connections, maybe. Commune of Women.
One of the things that I did in Commune of Women, in addition to looking into the life stories of the women themselves who are trapped, was to do outlines of the lives of several of the terrorists. They were a group of orphans who were all going to UCLA, and they were gathered together by a Catholic priest and a Muslim leader as a way to try to find some accord among them from all their disparate outlooks on life. But what happens is that they're subverted, and they're subverted in a way that I won't actually say how it happens, but it does implicate our government, the U.S. government.
Okay,
so
that's interesting, yeah.
In researching the lives of the terrorists, that was one of the most interesting parts of the research for me, was to go into each of these areas. Palestine is one of the main areas that because one of the protagonists is Palestinian, and to really begin myself to understand in depth, the political situation in various areas in the world.
There is an international flavor to all of this, of course.
Yes,
and
sir. Well, yeah, there always is.
I had it driven home to me when I was up in Canada, and I was just crossing back in the United States, and I was on a car ferry, and I was talking to one of the officers that runs the ferry, and she was saying, "You're not going to believe this." And I said, "Oh, why is that?" Because I just mentioned to her that I had just come back from Iraq. And she said, that the very first terrorist attack that was foiled in the United States, it was concerning the L.A. airport.
Really?
I don't know if you
knew. I didn't know that.
Right.
Yes, it was.
Right. Right.
That was
yes.
on. And that was actually on September 11th, wasn't it, Greg?
No. It was a few days before.
Was it? Okay.
And what it was the gal just happened to be standing there, and there was a Mediterranean, I think that's PC enough, Mediterranean-looking man, and he was standing there sweating and perspiring and shaking and looking around like he was about ready to be grabbed. Well, they watched him for a little bit, and of course, most Canadians, they're fairly amicable people, very welcoming, nowhere near as anal and retentive as Americans are up on our own border. But this guy was watching him and decided there was something wrong. So she walked over with a couple of assistants, and they had him open his trunk on his rented automobile. Now, everybody might recognize the story now. And there was a huge set of plastic explosives with timers in the entire trunk of the car.
Oh my goodness.
And that's what he was going to do, was he was going to drive down the I-5, the Interstate 5, to Los Angeles, and he was going to detonate that at the landmark LA airport. There's a great big, what is it, a restaurant there that's famous up in the air. Right there. That was going to be ground zero for basically the 9/11 attack. That's where I was supposed to start. I started. So yes, that you might have been pre-sciences in deciding to use the LA airport, because, in my opinion, LA can always use a little urban renewal of some sort. And one of the things that I had helped, and I haven't really mentioned this to any of your listeners, Steve, but I did help with a plot that I had actually picked up when I was in Iraq, of all things, in Iraq, and I had picked up a plot that was going to involve, and I picked it up from one of my Mukab Arat. Remember the very feared, very dangerous Mukab Arat, the Iraqi intelligence service of Saddam Hussein?
Yeah, sure.
Well, one of my sources there came in one day, and he was very excited, and said, look, Do you have some place in California where there's a big harbor in Southern California? And well, that narrows it down to about three or four places. And he said, well, here's what we just got. We just picked up in our own intelligence service, and it was something like this, that there was going to be a ship, Al-Qaeda was actually going to be responsible for it, and they were going to sail one of their 40 freighters. They had close to 40 freighters around the world that are registered to them and also through other companies. And they were going to sail a freighter into the Los Angeles Harbor, Long Beach, San Pedro Harbor.
And explode it?
I'm sorry?
And set it to explosion?
Right, and that's exactly what they were going to do, is it was going to be a dirty bomb. It wasn't going to be a nice, great, big, you know, 500 kiloton kind of thing.
Right.
No, this was going to be a bunch of dirty X-ray equipment and red glass dishware and that kind of stuff. And but the idea was that they were going to detonate this weapon system, this ship, in Los Angeles Harbor. And the actual idea was rather diabolical, because they were going to rely on something that goes like this. There's nobody more egotistical on the face of the earth than Los Angelinos, all right? People that live in Los Angeles. And for 11 million people to be able to look down at sunset and see hear a big boom and see a mushroom cloud rising above the harbor, and all of a sudden that would trigger the radioactivity sensors, what they're called theta sensors, would be triggered, and that would tell everybody that a big nuclear blast had just taken place. And so this terrorist attack was going to be is it was going to implement panic. Imagine that. Panic on the LA freeway.
Yeah. Okay. I got a question for Suzanne, Greg.
Yes.
Oh, great.
Yeah. Do you actually know who started the group Al-Qaeda?
Do I know?
Yeah.
I have no personal knowledge of this.
Oh, well, me and Greg know. They are...
I suspect.
Yeah, well, your suspicions are correct, because in the summer of 1979, the CIA and Zbigniew Brzezinski went into Afghanistan and gathered all of the tribes up and formed what was called the Mujahideen. Mm-hmm. And then shortly after that, the group Al-Qaeda sprung up and formed their own little terrorist network that's been funded by CIA and State Department and other worldly interests, haven't they, Greg?
Well, that Al-Qaeda, okay, is a rather unique case, because they were actually organized and formulated to respond to the Russian invasion of Afghanistan. And there was a very clear target. It was Russian military
But Greg, Zbigniew Brzezinski has been on record in one of his books gloating that they more or less goaded the Russians into attacking Afghanistan.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, well, that's...
I haven't heard that either. That's very interesting.
Yes.
I have not heard that, because, I mean, Afghanistan before that was a real mess.
Yeah.
Okay, a real political mess. And it's never been a stable area whatsoever, even though it's the crossroads of the world in terms of the Silk Road and so forth.
Yeah.
It's never been stable politically.
That entire area's been at war for thousands of years, and it will be at war for thousands more years after we're all gone.
Yeah, I don't think Alexander the Great was even able to subdue it.
No.
So, with the formation of the Al-Qaeda group itself, or that translates to the base, you had an organization which it's rather interesting in nature, okay? It was organized along the cellular line, the compartmentalized lines of an intelligence organization. So in other words, it was set up to where there would be automatic security within the group itself, and only a few people, okay, like the top one or two or maybe three, would know how the interaction of all the cells was working. So in other words, if one cell was discovered and captured, they would not be able to give up the rest of the cells. Okay, it's simple now, but most people don't understand that. And this is something that I've always maintained, is how ludicrous and ridiculous it is to torture captured terrorists, because they don't know. They were in an organization that was designed from the very beginning to protect itself, to limit damage and do damage control and limit the capture of the other operative cell.
Well, it's pretty much a pyramid scheme, isn't it, Greg, as far as the intelligence goes and the knowledge?
Yes. Well, I guess that's one way to put it. It's not like Amway or something like that. But,
right.
It was organized and logistics, and it was intelligence, and it was controlled. It was controlled. The leadership was trained in America. Everything was done by Americans for this group, all right? The financing was all done in-house with the agency and so forth. So that's why, as I've told your listeners many times, Steve, you talk about the organization and structure of Al-Qaeda, it's like, excuse me, we better check out this story again, because like 9/11, and I've spoken many, many times about 9/11, say who, say what,
well,
who did this?
It's not so much check out the story, Greg. It's more like check out the storytellers and check out where the money comes from and check out where the training comes from and check out where the origination of the whole concept and just check everything
that's
else.
Right. That's right. So that's why, and I'm sure, I usually have a pearl or two of wisdom concerning what's going on right now in the world. And as I mentioned to you just before the show started, Steve and Susan, is something like this, is the eyes of the world are on ISIS, all right? ISIS, which is now rampaging across northern and middle Iraq, all right? Now, everybody's talking, and of course our hand-wringing, overpaid, bloated, expert, quote, politicians all seem to think that it just kind of came out of nowhere, and I'm just waiting for the George Bushisms, where they start saying, oh, well, this could not be foreseen, nobody could have predicted this, and so forth. No, the ISIS organization, first of all, it isn't just angry Muslim people, okay? No, they're battle-hardened, very experienced, very tough, British, French, American fighters, and a large contingent of Saudis, and a large contingent of Syrians, probably a few Jordanians, thrown in to ginger things up. And believe me, they have the funding, the experience, the training to go the distance now, all right? And you can see what 1,500 men have done. What is 1,500 men? Just a little, a little under the size of a brigade.
Yeah.
And just a brigade of men. And in what, 2 or 3 weeks, they've managed to completely overrun virtually all of northern Iraq.
Surely.
Kurdistan.
Sure.
And, they're halfway down past Samarra.
Yeah. You were going to add something there, Suzanne?
Oh, I was just going to ask Greg, who do you think is funding them?
Well, I wasn't sure, but all I knew is that they have been well funded. Okay, I was looking at their equipment, I was looking at their uniforms, I was looking at their tactics, and these people are now panhandling, trying to get enough money up, from other discontents in the world to go do something. No, somebody has given them a blank check, and it shows. In their behavior, in their logistics, in their vehicles, in their uniforms, everything. Their weapons. I don't see any crappy old weapons that they're carrying. These are all nice new weapons that they're carrying. And so I thought, okay, somebody's behind this. And now they have the reputation of being the best paid terrorists in the world. Go figure. All right. how would they get paid? You know, what, do they have pay numbers, you know, for terrorist groups and a terrorist union or something?
Say, Greg, don't we have to look at the same sources from the past, like maybe the House of Saud or the Mossad or MI5 or CIA?
Oh, sure. Yeah, they've all got a piece in this. We won't mention Israel either. We're not going to mention them. Got it? Okay. It's all QT with them. But the thing is that I was just called and informed that it's of course Saudi Arabia. Who else could write a blank check, for something like this? And who else would have the motivation to remove, take over, because they've been, because the Saudis have been watching everything the Americans did in Iraq, and watching the debacle that unfolded in Iraq, and they realized that there would be a vacuum. When we left, there would be a tremendous vacuum left. I mean, you know, let's face it, when we invaded Iraq, the first thing we did was we disbanded their army. Oh, gosh, my grandmother would know better than to do something like that. How is a country supposed to defend itself when you go in and disband their military and then label all their leadership criminals? So not a good thing to do. And so in this case, the Saudis, which they're watching this, and they said, okay, we have a very violent, savage civil war going on in Syria. And most of the fighters want to get out of Syria if they can, because that's pretty much a foregone conclusion. So we have Iraq sitting there just like a fat hog waiting to be carved up. But then I noticed something novel, which I have told your listeners many times, Steve, is they targeted very select facilities. And of course, those facilities are the oil fields, and they targeted the oil refineries. Now, why would they do something like that? Why would a Saudi group, okay, that had extensive connections to the American government, specifically to Dick Cheney, an oil man himself, and why would they? And how about George W. Bush? An oil man himself, remember Arbusta? And how about George H.W. Bush, who not only sold weapons of mass destruction to Saddam Hussein, but then turned right around and arranged for all kinds of oil transports, all right, to be arranged clandestinely from Iraq. So, because Iraq and the Bush family go back a long ways, of course, they had to have the great Bush document purge to try to hide all that and destroy any evidence of that. So we have Bandar Bush. He is the rascal that is actually the man with his finger on the button on this issue. All right, Bandar Bush. You know, hopefully the folks in the UK remember, as I did, because I was sitting in about 130 degree temperature heat in Iraq when I saw a picture of Prince Bandar sitting at the Crawford, Texas ranch of George W. Bush, Bubba, and of course everybody's wearing cowboy boots. I'm going to have to get a set of cowboy boots so I can kind of look like they do, all right?
Yeah, but Greg, we want to get into what Suzanne has been writing about all of the turmoil and political upheaval in Central America.
There's a punchline to what Greg's saying, so let's hear the punchline, and then we'll go on with my books.
All right, Greg.
Okay, so in other words, Prince Bandar of Saudi Arabia is now taking over Iraq and all the oil facilities. Okay, what does that do to Saudi oil? That keeps the price elevated and controls Iraq. Has more oil than all the Mid East countries combined. All right, those are proven reserves. And so, what does ISIS do? ISIS goes in and takes over all these facilities. Well, what does that now? Who do they do it for? And what does that mean to the price of Saudi oil? All right, and the relationship to the Bush family. Okay, it's You know, it doesn't take a rocket surgeon to figure this one out, folks. All right? Yes, that whole thing, you know, which is a typical Bush bunch of chicanery, okay, has now manifested itself in ISIS, in a country that cost the lives of 12,000 Americans, cost several $1 trillion, and for what? So the Bush family and the Saudis could keep pumping that oil and keep that oil off the market as they see fit. That's what this is all about, folks, right there. So, yes, Central America, Susan.
Well, these kinds of machinations are exactly what my second book, Fiesta of Smoke, is concerned with, as well as Commune of Women. And Fiesta of Smoke takes place in Mexico. And specifically, it addresses the unrest in Chiapas in southern Mexico. And the CIA is implicated. One of my three main protagonists in the book is Hill, who is an international investigative reporter. And he says during the course of a conversation in southern Mexico, "Everywhere I go in the world, if I dig deep enough into the political unrest, I always find a CIA connection." And in the case of southern Mexico, the resources, just like the oil in Iraq, the resources are tremendous. There are hardwood forests to be logged. There's oil. There's uranium, all kinds of minerals that can be mined. And the sort of awkward thing for the international business community is that those lands are occupied by indigenous people who have been there for hundreds and possibly thousands of years. And so they have to find a way to dislodge them. And that is really the essence of the plot of Fiesta of Smoke, is that the great land holders, the big estancia owners, are in complicity with the government of the state of Chiapas and the governments of other states, because their bread is buttered by the big international mining concerns and conglomerates. And so they have hired what is called the Guardia Blanca, which is a band of terrorists, basically, who are heavily armed and who go around and terrorize the indigenous population. And
yeah,
that's factual. That's not my imagination at work. That's absolute fact.
Well, certainly it is. There have been, the Bushes, George Bush and some of the others, have gobbled up literally tens of thousands of acres down in South America because the water is just so plentiful down there, and eventually they will start using water down there as a weapon, as a
when I read that one of the Bush daughters had purchased 100,000 acres in the Amazon basin of watershed, I thought I was going to be ill. I really did. I thought, here's this little witless girl who has no imagining that there are people who live there. That's their world. And she thinks she owns this thing? And what is she going to do with it? You know, I mean, it's fantastically narcissistic what these, you know, these multi-billionaires are doing to the world. And they're doing it in Mexico. And so the plot of Fiesta of Smoke is that the hero of the book and the hero and heroine of the book are actually very deeply politically concerned and are trying all legal remedies to protect the indigenous peoples. And it finally comes to the point where they realize that because of the Guardia Blanca, the attacks by these terrorist groups, they're going to have to arm and they're going to have to start what essentially is a revolution.
Well, Suzanne, the big joke up here in America, to those of us that are in the know, the CIA pretty much runs the world's drug trade. They are the they are the biggest cartels in the world. They run the drugs into America, and they run the drugs into more than likely all of the other countries with the other countries' intelligence agencies' help. And
I have firsthand knowledge of this. through a contact of mine from the time I was in my 20s, a man who was a pilot who flew drugs into the country from South America and from Mexico. And he told me how they did it and, you know, just exactly how they went about getting it out of south of the border and into this country.
Yeah.
So it's been going on for a long, long time.
Yes, it has. I actually told Greg last week this. I seen a TV show. Maybe you know of this TV show. It's called The Person of Interest.
Uh-huh.
It's based out of New York there, and the main character is an ex-CIA guy and ex-military also, and he goes around capturing all of the he goes around helping people that are supposedly going to be killed. And one of these episodes, I told Greg last week that the main character stopped a big drug ring in New York, and it ended up being run by the CIA. And in the end, he told his little cop friend to not even bother trying to prosecute the head of this ring, because it was CIA. And then he made the statement that, Congress has kind of backed off on the money that goes into fighting terrorism, so that the CIA is running drugs into America to help fund the war on terror.
Right.
He actually said this with a straight face on the TV show, but I was laughing insidiously, and Greg got a big kick out of that too. So
entering the mainstream. You know, it's not a covert idea anymore at all.
No. The CIA is still the good guys. They're just running the drugs in to help fight terrorism. That's all.
No, Steve. Yeah.
It's a noble cause, right?
Yeah.
Now, Steve, understand this, and your listeners, that Susan can sit in her front room, okay, and look out across an open valley and about three ridge lines, and she can actually see the home where, and I told your listeners this many times, where Phil Marshall and his family were slaughtered, all right? And Phil Marshall was the pilot. He was a CIA pilot, and he wrote several books saying that the Saudis were entirely behind the 9/11 debacle, and we won't even call it a terrorist attack. It was just a debacle. And then the famous picture, which is just came out, okay, in the movie, okay, unthinkable, that picture showed Phil Marshall standing in an airport with a plane, Jeb Bush of the Bush family, that Jeb Bush, former governor of Florida, right. And then Barry Seal. All right. Well, I find it interesting that, surprise, two of the three people in the photo are dead now. All right. Dead by gunshot wounds. How did that happen? Barry Seal was going to testify against George H.W. Bush. And the day before he was going to fly from New Orleans to Washington, he was killed. All right. He was killed behind in a parking lot with several gunmen carrying Uzis. Okay. And then, of course, Phil Marshall, as I investigated, near Susan's home there, as I investigated, along with Wayne Madsen, that murder, that was very clearly another execution style, business regulation of the agency. All right. Two children and Phil Marshall himself and the family dog. Okay. They didn't want to waste any time at all. They killed the dog.
Well, okay. Of course, Greg, everybody knows when you want to suicide murder yourself, you got to kill your dog too.
Right, exactly. Right. Okay.
The day I saw that in the headline of our local paper, I said to my husband, that's a hit. There is no question about it. No man does this to his family. This is madness.
Especially a former pilot for the CIA itself, who'd written three books, and the fourth, by the way, the manuscript was never found for the fourth book, which was supposed to be the blockbuster, which named names.
Yeah.
And indicts everybody.
Certainly.
That was involved.
Certainly.
But
right.
You know, before you commit suicide, you really want to do away with your computer, right?
Yeah.
Yes.
Exactly.
Yes, I agree. So now, let me see. Where are we at now? Okay, now as I recommended on your last show, that I thought that we should have a good reaction and response to ISIS, and we should have Blackwater go in and take on ISIS. If Blackwater is supposed to be so tough and trained so well and supposed to be the killer elite, let's have Blackwater do it. All right.
Well, let's see, Greg. 1,500 ISIS fighters. I'm gonna say you're probably gonna need at least 60,000 Blackwater forces and probably 100,000 U.S. military forces.
You're probably correct, Steve. Yeah. Your logistics and your tactics are probably pretty sound. But there's only one problem here.
Yeah.
Only one problem is that most of Blackwater are busy guarding the opium fields. 80% of the opium is produced in Afghanistan. So guess where Blackwater is?
Right.
All right.
Yep.
And guess where Blackwater is in Central America and South America?
Guess what
they're doing?
They wouldn't be guarding the cocaine, would they?
No.
On these top secret missions that the U.S. military sends special forces in with helicopters and stuff into South America, like they did back in the 80s and 90s, they wouldn't possibly fly over two or three cocaine factories just to bomb another one, a few miles past, would they?
Well,
you mean arrival?
Arrival. Yes, that's what I was trying to get to.
Yes. I think if you saw there was a movie called Catch 22, and it was famous for that. It's where Americans were working with the Germans to call in airstrikes on supply warehouses to make sure that money was to be made on the black market. With those supplies, that weren't destroyed by the Germans. Okay, so if you remember, Art Garfunkel was in the movie, and he was standing there with a radio guiding German Hinkel bombers in to make the final run on American warehouses. All right, so that's where it all started, okay, with Catch 22 and World War II.
Yeah.
And I don't think it's changed much at all.
Probably not.
All right?
And you know what? I'll bet if I was able to probe into just about any kind of police force and ask the questions how many times they pass up one or two crack houses to go bust a different one a few extra miles away, I just wonder what kind of an answer I would get.
Now, Steve, ask Susan, and your listeners will love this. When I sent Susan a message from Iraq saying that I was being strapped to a stretcher and I was being shot full of drugs.
Oh yeah.
And Susan was to notify some officials that I named, and Susan, let the listeners know what happened next, because it is fascinating.
Well, that was one of the more amazing things that's ever happened to me. I had been up for 2 days trying to catch Greg in real time so we could talk back and forth with email. And finally we were able to, and first Greg said that he was going to have to file charges against his own intelligence group because they were torturing. And so I wrote him back and asked, what do you mean by torture? And he responded that he was seeing people hauled up with their hands behind their back so that their shoulders were pulled out of the sockets and people were sitting on them until they couldn't breathe anymore and went unconscious, that kind of thing. And as things progressed, then of course he was being followed 24 hours a day and being subjected to psychological evaluations, and things were really heating up, and I was getting very worried about him. And finally, the word came that he was going to leave the country. And as that message had come in, I stepped out of my study onto a little porch outside, and I was talking on the phone with a friend of mine telling her the latest update, and I hear a helicopter coming. And right up over the ridge, I live right up on top of a mountain, and up over the ridge comes a black helicopter, and it comes directly to my house, which is very isolated in a rural area, and hovers about 30 feet above me and my study. I was busy looking at for markings, for anything that I could identify it with. There was nothing. It was a completely unmarked black helicopter. The bubble all blacked out so you couldn't see inside. And my friend on the phone said, "What is that sound?" And I said, "It is an unmarked black helicopter, and I think I'm about to die." Because I really thought that they were going to come and just kill me. And because, you know, this information about torture had been leaked to me from Iraq. So like any good red-blooded American girl, I just lifted up my right hand and gave them the one-finger salute and expected to die in the process. But they stayed, I don't know, maybe only 2 or 3 minutes, and then off they went, dashing away again. And so that was kind of curious, and I didn't know what to make of it. And then the following night, I was home alone, and I was upstairs in my home. My study's on the ground floor. And I heard the study door close. It's a very heavy door. It makes a very distinctive sound when it closes. And I immediately was pretty alarmed because that meant someone was in the house with me. And so I always keep a .38. I grabbed my .38, and I went out to the balcony that overlooks the ground floor studio and saw a figure racing out of my study and across my studio and out the north side door. And in the morning, the file of Greg's emails, which I had been keeping because I felt that they would probably someday be evidence in some kind of a whistleblower case, and I had buried it very deep in among other things, the file was sitting dead center of my computer screen. So they had unearthed it and probably copied it and then left.
And he was probably about to delete it until you caught him.
That's a possibility, too, although I wasn't aware of his presence in the house until he left the study. That the study door closing was him leaving and crossing my studio, and that's what alerted me. So I think they left it as a message. You know?
Yeah,
we've been here and we've done that. You know?
Yeah, but a lot of us know also that the American media and the American government saying that those black helicopters don't exist. So,
well, I can testify that they absolutely do. And the fascinating thing to me is I live in a very remote place, and that helicopter was here within 10 minutes of that final message from Greg. So the closest base that it could have come from was in a town called Merced, which is, I don't know, probably 75 miles from where I live.
Right.
So it made me wonder, do they have black helicopters on every frigging base in the country so that they can terrorize people with them at a moment's notice, you know?
You might actually be closer to some underground bunker that is still yet unknown to you and others.
Well, that's true, too. I do have an important communications link very close to my house that is a communication link for the whole country.
Yeah. Well, a lot of reports are out there, Suzanne, that some of them helicopters, well, we do know that they actually do have some helicopters that can travel, I think, like 250 miles an hour.
And it was fast. It was small and it was fast.
Yeah.
That's all I know about it. I don't know helicopters from a can of beans, but
Well,
it was fast.
A lot of them are actually jet propelled and
really,
yeah, and they can just move and quickly.
Well, what Susan is describing and has described is something called the Bell Jet Ranger. All right, and that is the helicopter of choice for, you know, for covert harassment like this. Yes, it does fly very quickly. Does fly very fast. It's a tried and true helicopter in these situations. Now, the thing was that concerns me is that send a message, okay, halfway around the world, and the message shows up on a screen on top of a mountain, in a computer on top of a mountain, okay, nowhere near any major military facility, obviously, and within, 10 minutes, Susan? Now, how could they have locked on unless they already had electronic surveillance, electronic warfare already working? Because there's only one way to do that, and there is an electronic helicopter that specializes in that. And it wasn't the one that was flying above Susan's house, okay? That was just an harassment. They were just letting you know that they're onto you, okay? And
you had said at the time that you thought they could tap into my computer, but I was on a landline, and a very slow landline at that time. Mm-hmm. And so you thought maybe their technology was too advanced for what I was presenting to them.
Well, very clearly, they weren't looking around. They weren't flying around saying, oh, well, it could be over here. It could be there.
Great. Yeah. They
came directly to the house. Okay.
Oh, yeah.
That's what concerns me.
Absolutely.
They came directly to the house. So, in other words, anybody in America, anybody in Europe can have one of these things. If you say something that somebody doesn't like, especially George W. Bush or the Department of Defense or Dick Cheney or Donald Rumsfeld, they can have one of these helicopters park its skids right on top of your chimney, okay, within 10 minutes, basically.
Right,
okay.
Right.
Without any exaggeration, that's true. Okay. If they could fly to Susan's house and do exactly what they just did, or what she just described, that means there's very few places in the Western world that they can't do that, also, in the same place, in the same time. All right. So, yes, indeed, that was a watershed moment, okay, for America. When I send a message of warning about what is happening, some our hideous war crimes and atrocities that were happening in Iraq, which is, by the way, and your listeners know, the greatest set of war crime scandals that America's ever been involved in, period, okay. And in this situation, okay, it's immediately targeted. Okay, the recipient was targeted, and a message was sent. And the next night, there was a break-in. Okay, that's what's so amazing to me is that a local contractor, some local dirtbag, was hired by the government to break into Susan's house, and they also knew that her dog wasn't there. Also, Susan had a great big
Rottweiler,
okay, by the name of Graffin, and they knew that somehow they knew that Graffin wasn't there, all right? So they knew that they could walk into that house, unmolested, and record and download.
Well, I'm sure that was...
computer.
Yeah, Greg, I'm sure that they had a full infrared scope of the house before they even did anything.
Mm-hmm.
They probably seen all the little bugs that were crawling along the wall or the floorboard or something. I'm sure that they seen every single life force that was in that house.
Well, yes. I think what it was they had the infrared, because you can actually do infrared of an entire house, and somebody upstairs, somebody downstairs, you can see them moving.
Yeah.
Or I use the same system in Iraq, okay? When we were in Samarra and we were being attacked every night, we had this system, it's called the FLIR system, and where you can bring it in, we had it flown in with a helicopter, and you could turn it, and you could look and see all the buildings. You could see what everybody was doing inside the buildings, like getting ready to attack us, all right?
Yeah, certainly.
And so that is a strong possibility that, yes, one of those helicopters had that capability.
Yeah.
Okay, I was watching, because they obviously knew when Susan was alerted that somebody was in the house, and they notified the dirtbag that, yes, she was coming down the stairs with a gun in her hand, going to relieve this scumball from existence. All right.
Well, certainly.
So they
certainly
knew that. And that's why he left the house. They're running, all right?
Oh, yeah.
He wasn't walking casually. He was running.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, he ran.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Well, say the two of you, this hour is up. Were you just planning on doing just the 1 hour, or...
Oh,
or
well,
did you want to do some more?
Right. Well, Susan, how are you up to it?
I'm up to it, yeah. And we still have one more book to talk about, so there's there's time for that. That's
well, actually, let me put a song on, and I can approach you to about something. I'd like to take a little break here, and any AC/DC song suit you, Greg, or?
Okay. Oh, well, let me see. How about Guns N' Roses, Sweet Child of Mine? All right. As a tribute to the psych warfare guys in Samoa.
Okay, let me see if I have that in my...
That was your favorite song, by the way.
Yeah. I know I've had that in the past. Sweet Child of Mine. I would actually have to go grab that and make that into an MP3 to...
Or AC/DC, You Shook Me All Night Long.
Okay, I can do that.
You'll never go wrong with that.
Yeah. I've even got a bunch of Creedence Clearwater Revival, too, or...
You must have been reading my mind. I was going to say, do you have any Creedence Clearwater?
Oh, I love them. What do you want to hear, Suzanne? Does it matter? I'll put a couple of them on. Some of them are quite short, so I got Proud Mary here. Let's put that
one
on.
Oh, there you go.
Never on Proud Mary.
All right, everyone. I'll be back in a couple of minutes here. All right. Sorry, everyone, for that little bit of silence. I thought I had a few more seconds, and then I looked up, and the song was all over. So I hope it wasn't very long of silence there. But we are back. We are going to continue on here. I still have Dr. Suzanne Still and Dr. Greg Ford. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
It's our pleasure, as always.
Yeah, yeah. We were going to discuss, what were we talking about? My ADHD
Everything.
Is kicking in there. Everything, huh? Let's talk about your book some more, Suzanne, yes. Talk about the Central America upheaval.
Well, we had started talking about the CIA and their flights with drugs and all of that. And the third book that I have written, which is in the publication process right now, it's already on pre-order on Amazon, and it will be out in the winter, is a sequel to Fiesta of Smoke. It's entitled Well in Time.
And Well in Time.
Well in Time. And it deals with the drug cartels and their terrorism, really, of the Mexican population. I've traveled for 30 years in northern Mexico, in particular in Chihuahua, up in the Sierra. And when I first started traveling in Chihuahua, to go to Chihuahua City, for example, which is the capital, I could walk out alone at night and, you know, take part in street fairs and buy food on the street and listen to music. And it was a very relaxed and joyful atmosphere. Two decades later, you don't go out at night. Nobody goes out at night. And the cartels have really taken over the city. And one of the last times I was there, there was an assassination of the police chief. They shot him. He survived. They took him to the hospital. They did emergency surgery on him, put him in the ICU, and the assassins came back and murdered him in the ICU. That was the first assassination in the history of the drug wars in Chihuahua, and now they are a daily event there. And so when you do that kind of terrorism, you don't just kill certain people, you kill an entire culture. And that's what I've watched happen, that this joyous, open, culturally diverse and interesting city has shut itself down out of fear. And it's happening all over Mexico, and I assume all over Latin America. I don't have firsthand, you know, experience that, but in Mexico, I certainly do.
Yeah. So, what year was that the police chief's murder?
I'm trying to think. It's been within the last 10 to 11 years, I would say.
Okay.
And in the intervening years, the violence has just, you know, increased exponentially. And up in the Sierra, where, you know, in Copper Canyon, where it's always been such a pleasure to go, the Tarahumara Indians live there. The canyon itself is a tourist draw. The Chihuahua El Pacifico Railroad runs up, which is one of the great engineering marvels of the world. It was, you know, really a wonderful place to go. Well, the last time I was there, which has been, oh gosh, I'm sorry, I don't have dates, but it's probably been within the last 5 or 6 years. The week after I was there, there was a huge drug hit where SUVs with blacked out windows tore into the town of Creel, blocked the major intersection through which I had traveled numerous times during my visit, pulled people out of their cars. The cartel members were reaching into their SUVs for plastic baggies filled with cocaine and just taking handfuls and throwing it up their nose. I mean, it was wild. Then they went and shot up a local house of a person that I know. And all of this they filmed and put it on YouTube. You can see it on YouTube.
Yeah, great.
And that's just to terrify people, you know?
Certainly it is, yeah.
Yeah. So the book, The Well in Time, deals with...
How does somebody actually get a hold of that? How do they pre-order?
It can be pre-ordered on Amazon. My battery is going out on my phone. I'll have to go upstairs and grab another phone real quick.
Okay.
Greg, you take over while I do it, okay?
It'd be my pleasure. One of the things that Susan had mentioned was the spiking, you know, in violence in Mexico. Okay, but Mexico was at that time was on the tail end of the highway, the Coke Highway, and I was during about the same time I was in Central America, and I was actually in northern Panama on the Caribbean side, and which is some of the more remote area, you know, on the entire globe. The whole coast from Costa Rica, Guatemala, all the way down the Mosquito Coast of Nicaragua to northern Panama. And I was there, and I was working with the Acuna Indians, and they're the famous Indians that make the molas, the stitched molas, and they live on platforms out in the ocean. And one of the things that I did not realize before I went down there, we were on a plane one night and said we have to be in Latin America the next day, and then we were flown in and met at the airport in Panama City, and we were loaded up on the flying boxcars and then flown for 2 hours northeast, and then we landed in the middle of the jungle and were kicked out of the plane. And so when the sun came up, I was out in the middle of the jungle and really had no idea where I was or what was going on. But at that time, I learned from speaking to the Acuna Indians and the Wari Wari and the Harami Indians that are the native indigenous to that section of northern Panama coast, is that that whole area had become a major cocaine highway. And it was coming up from, of course, Colombia and Ecuador and was it Guyana, and these had all turned into major coke plantations, factories. We'll call them factories. But who would ever guess that where I was in northern Panama, it had the highest murder rate in the world, the highest murder rate.
Now it's supplanted by Juarez.
Right. Juarez is a nightmare in itself, especially
for
the women.
It's become the most violent city in the world, even more than Bogota.
Right. Yeah, hundreds of murders a year happen there. And so, needless to say, and I think I had mentioned, I'd sent Susan a letter from northern Panama at the time, telling her that I had been sitting on a ridgeline overlooking the Caribbean one day, and I had a group of guerrillas, as in not mountain gorillas, but guerrillas, okay, carrying weapons and so forth, AK-47s, walk up behind me. And fortunately, they were more interested in what was going on in the town below me, and they were actually mules. They were actually carrying cocaine up from Central America. This was coming from the Darien province of Panama, which is right next door to Colombia. And they were more interested in going into town and getting something to eat and seeing some friends, having a good time, and getting any medical issues straightened out. And that was one of the ways that my medical training has saved me is I was completely surrounded by these guys before I knew it, and they asked me if I had any money, And I said, I had 22 Balboas. I don't know if your listeners know what Balboas are, but that's the currency form in Panama. And I gave them all my money that I had, and they thanked me profusely, by the way. They could have taken it if they wanted it, but they thanked me.
Yeah.
And then they went into town, had a great time in town, came back, and they noticed my medical bag, and they wanted medical treatment. So I ended up treating them free of charge, of course. Okay. That's the bottom line to all this adventure, it's free. And I sent them on their way. All right. So that was about the same time that the assassination was happening in Chihuahua province. And at that time that the entire eastern coast of the Caribbean of Central America, had been taken over with drug traffic. And anybody that's in their way, doesn't matter who they are, they're dead. All right. It's just that simple. I worked on I provided medical support for a wall. Okay. There's actually they call it a fence to be politically correct, but it's actually a wall, that runs from the Pacific Ocean to the Arizona border. And I worked with the construction crews that were putting it up. And as we were drilling, I don't know if I've ever mentioned this to Susan, but as we were drilling to set the foundations for the wall, you can see the wall, by the way, anytime on, was it Border Wars? Okay, it's a regular show on cable. We were drilling, and virtually every third hole that we drilled, we came up with human bones, all right? And it's a shock to come up with a child's, a young child's, about 10 years old, leg bone with a little running shoe attached to it. Okay, you never forget that. But it turns out that the drug cartels had enlisted by force these young people. And what was happening was where the other drug cartels would capture these children that were carrying these backpacks of cocaine, take the cocaine and shoot the child. Okay, shoot the kid that was carrying it. All right. So we were seeing the end result of that. Yeah, you know, when we were trying to, you know, there was no border, okay, between California and Mexico. Everybody thinks there is because they've seen movies with checkpoints, okay, like in San Diego. But there was no real border, okay. And I got the impression that very few people wanted a border, to be honest. So anyway, that's what was happening just about the same time that Susan was in Copper Canyon in Chihuahua. With another mutual friend, by the way, who's quite a character, and he appears in their book. And this was beginning to happen, and now the whole place is a battlefield. All right, it's a battlefield, and who is right in the middle of this battlefield? It's Blackwater. Blackwater. Okay, who else? Okay, but is handling the drug cartel and doing drug enforcement of, you know, for cartel business and agency business.
You know what they need, Greg? You know what Blackwater needs? They need to have Hollywood come out with a TV series just for them, showing them that they're the good guys. I mean, look at it. The FBI has got their own series. The CIA has their own series. And who knows? There's probably even a British MI5 or MI6 or something. I'm sure that they have their own series showing that they're the good guys. So I think maybe that's what Blackwater needs.
Well, how about James Bond?
Yes. Yeah.
Well, what would you call it? Amway Tonight, or CSI Amway, or what?
I don't know. They have very, very high prestigious advertising firms that can figure out a good name for them. So I don't really know.
As a result of this violence that Greg is talking about, all the drug trafficking that comes up from South America, it hits the border, you know, Arizona, California, Arizona, Texas, New Mexico, and all the little villages in Mexico that are right up against the border are places you really don't even want to go. They are just nests of armed gunmen. And what's happened with the indigenous people and the local people is that they're having to defend themselves against the cartels. And there are whole towns that have banded together to become militia to protect their lands and their families from the power of the cartels or the mafias, the drug mafias. So that's a phenomenon that's happening right now in Mexico, and that is having legal repercussions because, of course, the state doesn't want militia operating, you know, inside its borders, even though they've turned a blind eye to the Guardia Blanca for years. But the book that's about to come out, Well in Time, deals with the necessity to arm oneself and to train people to defend local lands against the cartels.
Yeah, I know. It's very, very prevalent, and it's very, very high up on, you know, it goes up into the highest echelons of every government. They're all.
Yes, it does. Yes, it does. The Mexican, you know, government, I mean, there's talk about Mexico being a failed state, and you know, it's always denied officially that it is a failed state. But really, in actuality, the government can't control the activity of the cartels. And truth be told, they're paid not to.
Certainly they are. Well, they're either paid not to or they don't last very long.
Or they don't last very long.
If
exactly.
They try.
The agency, of course, it's in its best interest to make sure that this none of this traffic stops, slows down. None of this bad behavior stops, okay? That's when money is to be made, is when you have a semi-anarchic state like Mexico is in now, all right? You know, fear is a pervading factor. And of course it always masquerades as something self-righteous and sanctimonious. There's always a religious note, a religious feel to it. But the thing that sticks in my mind the most was a few years back I received a call, and the caller basically said, "You're not going to believe this. The agency just had one of their Gulf Streams." I don't know if your listeners know what a Gulf Stream is, but they're it's a huge, expensive private plane. Okay, you know, you just picture a bunch of experts and bloated bureaucrats flying around on a plane. You've got a Gulf Stream, all right? Well, it just belly flopped on the Yucatan Peninsula. And on board, there was something like 6 tons of cocaine. It belly flopped. The crew ran off into the jungle. They were never found, of course. And the plane had 6 tons of cocaine on board, and it was part of the Air America fleet. And the thing that is ironic is it had several crated human beings on board. And when I say crates, I mean dog crates. That's how terror suspects are moved around, quote, terror suspects are moved around. Usually, from what I'm seeing, is terror suspects are usually the competitors of some of our contractors and associates of our intelligence agencies that have caused a problem for our competitors. So they end up in a dog crate. And I mean, when you see these things, yes, you expect to see Bozo the dog looking out, but you see a human being looking out of it instead. You can't sit up, you can't stretch your legs out, you can't turn in one, and these people are left inside those dog crates for days on end, all right? So they were sitting on that Gulf Stream when it belly flopped on the runway. So isn't that ironic? The war on terror produces this plane with 6 tons of cocaine on board, and several crated, quote, terrorist suspects are on board when that happened. So there's very little doubt. I'm sorry, Susan.
Oh, well, one of the fascinating books that I read doing research for this latest book, Well in Time, is a book called To Die in Mexico by a man named John Gibler. And he's an American journalist who is really quite courageous, and he's going into these areas where there's so much violence and doing research and talking with fellow journalists, many of whom are since assassinated. And he cites that particular incident, and he talks about how much money is made every day by the drug trafficking. And what do you do with that much cash? One of the fascinating things that he brings up is that this cash is held in major U.S. banks, banks that we all know, Bank of America,
certainly,
Wells Fargo, and that, and that in 2008, when the economy crashed and the government itself was in dire straits, what did they do? They went to the banks and they took out drug money to run things.
Well,
and in that way, billions of illicit dollars entered mainstream economy.
Yeah. Wells Fargo, down there in South America somewhere, I think it was Wachovia, Wells Fargo, at the time, they got caught laundering $384 billion, and they got hit with a $100 million fine. That's about like,
well, that's pocket change.
Yeah, that's like stealing $20 million from a bank and flipping the cops a $10 bill on the way out.
Exactly. I have a friend who, for various reasons, basically because he grew up with some of the people who later became involved in drugs. And he's a very imposing sort of a person. And so one day he got an invitation to a penthouse suite in Mexico City to one of the major drug people who said, "I want you to work for me. I will give you $300,000 a week.
A week?
All the airplanes, cars, and women that you want, and you'll run the Juarez end of the cartel for me."
I'll be darned, yeah.
I mean, that kind of money is like, $300,000 a week. It's like, that was just to begin with, that was just for starters.
Yeah.
Yeah,
but once somebody gets into that world, they can never get out. The only way they get out is...
They can never get out, and he, of course, refused. And,
yeah.
Is carrying two bullets in the center of his brain, still alive and still well, but as a result.
Just for turning them down.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, we assume so.
Yeah, well, I guess you don't even want to be approached by them people in the first place. You don't even...
No. I don't know what you do. There's nothing in Emily Post for a situation like that,
The choice that they give you, from what I understand, is and it comes right down to this. It's either lead or gold. You can take
your
pick, but you're going to choose. And if you say, "Well, no, sorry, I want to go live my life without having to look over my shoulder or worry about being burned alive in a burn barrel or being thrown into a wood chipper," they don't give you the choice. They don't give you the option, and that's where the lead comes in. They'll put a bullet into your head, or in this case, two bullets. Into your head. So,
and not only that, but your families too. It's really escalated so that no one is safe, women and children and old people, and they'll take the whole family just to make a point.
That's absolutely
it's a reign of terror. It's a reign of terror, and it's what the answer is really a mystery at this point. I do feel like the war on drugs is part of it. I think that the real war is directed at small-time drug users and
we never really had this type of a serious problem with drugs until they began the war on drugs.
Exactly. Using all these drugs?
We never really had a big serious problem with homelessness until there was a war on homelessness.
Right.
There was no problems with terrorism until we had a war on terrorism.
Right. So you have to you have to follow the money and find out why it's, why it's valuable for people to have such a war.
Now, the irony to what you just described, Steve, is that virtually every group that you're speaking of is 3 to 5 times stronger than they were at the beginning, all right? Now, how does it happen if we just launched, two massive wars and we're getting ready to launch some more wars, by
bureaucracy,
the way.
Greg. It's bureaucracy and it's money.
And Al-Qaeda is now 3 to 5 times stronger than it ever has been. How many third in commands do we have to kill of Al-Qaeda to get their numbers down? I agree with Robin Williams. Every time you turn around, they're killing a number three in charge of Al-Qaeda. But as far as from what I can remember, they've killed at least six number three, that were in command of Al-Qaeda. When Susan mentioned that, I sent a note, an email, saying that, yes, they were raising people up behind their arms. They call it trapaging, by the way. Trapage is something that was used during the Inquisition, right, and the auto de fe. And I actually watched, we didn't know it at the time, but we had the second in command in Al-Qaeda behind Al-Zarqawi. We had the second in command in our hands. I was talking to him and speaking with him, and he was speaking back. Our guys came in and decided to hang him by his arms backwards and popped both of his arms out of their sockets. And I had to rotate both of his arms back in. Of course, he was screaming, okay, beyond, and it sounded like an animal, okay. That was one of my rougher orthopedic classes that I've had to teach, okay. So needless to say, in Iraq, I saw firsthand Al-Qaeda at its finest. And I saw no evidence of any diversion or what's the word, unacceptance of anything that wasn't in their regiment, okay, as a group. They were devoted, they were dedicated, and they knew exactly who they were dealing with when it came to Christian crusaders, all right? So Al-Qaeda is here to stay. Thanks to the Bush family, the Al-Qaeda is here to stay. Always remember who Poppy Bush was having breakfast with on the morning of 9/11, all right? And never forget who the Bush family cleared the way to have shipped out of the country on their own private jet 10 hours after 9/11 hit, all right? It was the Bush family. So needless to say, the Al-Qaeda is stronger than ever before, and now we have a hybrid called ISIS that is absolutely rocking the world back, especially the Middle East, back on its heels. And then we have the drug trades that are financing all of this, and they've never been so strong. They're taking entire countries over.
And don't forget the official institutions like the World Bank that are depleting the resources from third world countries as fast as they possibly can, and leaving the people, first enslaving them to work for them, and then leaving them poorer than when they arrived. When I first started traveling up in the Sierra in Mexico, the high plateaus there are deeply wooded with beautiful pine forests. And in the 25 years that since their World Bank funded a huge paper mill up on top of the Sierra, I have watched as illegal logging has stripped those mountains. You can't even find a big pine tree anymore. There are some little poles left, and that's it. And every road is filled with these falling apart trucks with logs cut for the paper mill. And so the Tarahumara, who were a marginalized people to begin with, I mean, they were farmers who barely were hanging on. Now there's erosion. The streams that they fished are filled with mud, and they're being forced off their lands by the cartels, or they're being forced to grow marijuana or opium poppies up there. I mean, both the unofficial and the official institutions are impacting that area, so it's going to be picked like a chicken bone, you know? There's not going to be anything left on it.
Well, certainly, that's... That's what the military industrial complex does, and that's what the...
They do. That's how they do it.
Exactly.
And the indigenous people, well, they can just, they can just go to the city and beg, which is what they're doing.
Well, it's like John, it's like Greg says a lot, if there's some precious mineral or some other type of commodity that the that they actually want and need, they send Johnny on the spot, Al-Qaeda, in and create a upheaval.
Right.
Justification.
Justification.
Right?
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
Problem, reaction, solution.
You notice that in places that are really unexciting and uninteresting, like Mongolia Okay. I mean, unless you're a Mongolian, you know, you like Mongolia, but
right.
But how many terrorist attacks of Al Qaeda do you see happening in Mongolia? Right.
Yeah.
Very few, if any. Okay.
You know, that was a joke that came out late last year. It was a Facebook post. It was something about Canada. They had found a oil reserve up there, and I think it had President Obama's face on the poster, and it said, "Oh, there's oil in Canada. Oh, geez, maybe we should go there to send them democracy." Oh, wait a minute, they have democracy already. Yeah.
Right. Yep.
We're just
another gift.
Yeah, we're just
the world.
We're just sending democracy to these places that don't have it, it seems.
Now, one of the things that's fascinating to me is these countries, I mean, we have these human rights commissions and so forth that launch these big investigations and refer to people and issue warrants for their arrest, like Dick Cheney, George W. Bush, Donald Rumsfeld, Paul Wolfowitz. Let's not forget that little loser. And do you see any of those people, you know, wearing striped pajamas? Do you see any of those people inside a federal prison? No. Why is that? It's
they're not paying their dues, are they, Greg?
It escapes me.
Yeah, none of them people are paying their dues, are they?
I found out, as I said on your show the other day, that why wasn't, you know, Robert Mueller, you know, former head of the FBI for 12 years, why wasn't he bringing charges against any of these people? Like Alberto Gonzalez, okay, who has an interesting way of handling investigations by his department of clearly corrupt companies. I don't know if you remember what I pointed out about Alberto Gonzalez is, besides destroying the tenets of the Constitution, he had actual people of his investigative teams in the Department of Justice murdered, all right? And the teams that were investigating the companies that he either had an interest in or had worked for, all of a sudden, here's all these investigators getting dead, all right? Now, like I said, you know, I'm not the smartest guy in the world. You know, I'm probably not the most astute or the most analytical, but I can put two and two together. So, you know, aren't there enough people in our system left to where we can say, look, okay, if it's going to happen in the premier law enforcement agencies of the world,
yeah, but Greg,
has to be done.
But yeah. Greg, you actually have to find people that aren't willing to piss their pants whenever somebody threatens them. That's what you.
Oh,
I think that's a key to it, right there.
Well, now you're asking a little too much. You know, I mean,
yeah.
You know, when I said why didn't Robert Mueller go after the Bushes? I mean, with a Bocce bank, billions of dollars disappeared into the Bocce bank. As I told your listeners, Abu Sager, Susan knows that name very well. Abu Sager told me in Iraq that it was the Bocce bank who had George H.W. Bush headed up, who set up with the Iraqi banks the purchase of weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, all right, from American firms and American military posts like Fort Rucker. And it was the Bocce bank that was responsible. Okay, well, I think your listeners remember what happened. Abu Sager was beaten to death, okay, and I was brought in to identify his body. And then of course the Bocce bank goes bankrupt. Remember that? It goes bankrupt overnight. All the hand-wringing from our bureaucracies. And guess who cut the sweetheart deal with George H.W. Bush? It was Robert Mueller of the FBI. All right? So, you know, when the law systems go of a country, when they can be compromised as easily as something like, I think your listeners remember, like George W. Bush and Karl Rove identifying who the pedophiles were, who were sitting on the bench. Okay. Yes, they can be identified. And they can be blackmailed.
Well, certainly they can, because they're the ones that compiled all the information from the CIA.
Absolutely. Okay. Well, do you remember the time that I think everybody remembers when George W. Bush and Karl Rove tried to fire six judges
right
on the bench? Do you
right
remember that?
Yeah.
What happened? Right. Well, it turns out that they couldn't be compromised. That they weren't taking drugs. They weren't embezzling funds.
They weren't molesting children, yeah.
Molesting little boys. They weren't molesting little girls.
Yep.
Okay. Or they weren't sacrificing.
That's why they wanted them off. Exactly.
Yeah. And so what happened? They were fired.
Yep.
Okay. And you remember the unbelievable debacle that followed.
Correct me if I'm wrong, the two of you. Didn't Bill Clinton get rid of a whole snot load of judges also?
I don't remember that.
I think he did.
I don't remember that either, no.
Huh.
Now, I know he tried to get... Who was the independent... Kenneth Starr.
Ken Starr, yeah.
Now, yeah, Ken Starr tried to prosecute him, and probably rightfully so, all said and done. But, I mean, where would Hillary be if Ken Starr had been, you know, allowed to go where he wanted to go and investigate what he wanted to, okay, and where he wanted to? Okay, where would Hillary be today? Okay. But I know that Bill Clinton was trying to get rid of him. Okay, so that's the only issue where I know where like an independent counsel was appointed where a president tried to have. Oh wait, I'm sorry. Richard Nixon and who was the independent counsel that was appointed for the Watergate investigation? What was his name? Jaworski, Leon Jaworski. Yes, yes. See, my average intelligence and average memory come through with it every time. Leon Jaworski was the one who said Nixon was a crook and should be removed. And of course, what did Nixon do? He tried to have Leon Jaworski removed and fired. And Bill Clinton tried to do the same thing with Ken Starr. So, I guess that's a time-honored tradition that politicians have is when they want to provide for appearances and they want to look like they're sort of adhering to that old antiquated document that doesn't have any relevance to today's judicial system, according to the Gonzo judicial law system.
Right.
That's Alberto Gonzalez, by the way.
Yeah.
I guess they just fire them, okay?
Well, certainly.
And those fired judges or whoever they are better not have the audacity to try to fight their way back and get their jobs back, okay? That's just un-American, okay? And that's what happened with George W. Bush when he fired those judges and Karl Rove fired those. Can you imagine Karl Rove having the audacity to tell somebody, anybody, that they weren't good enough to do a certain job in the American government? Karl Rove? Okay. Gosh, that's like asking Himmler, of Nazi fame, about urban renewal, okay? I mean, it's the same comparison, all right? And the irony of that is now, and as I heard this the other night, thank God we have revisionists in this country, okay, that revised history, that first of all, everybody's very glad that Dick Cheney has started to recover.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And they're talking about having Karl Rove run for some kind of political office because he has so much support. I want to know who these people are that are saying that Dick Cheney is such a wonderful guy, and especially it couldn't be his best friend that he shot in the face with a shotgun. Okay, couldn't be that poor bastard. No, but I want to know who would have the audacity and the temerity to say that that Karl Rove should run for political office.
Yeah,
you'd get it.
Great,
right?
I do remember this now, and I just looked it up. Department of Justice noted in 1981, Reagan's first year in office, 71 of the 93 districts had new U.S. attorneys. In 1993, Clinton's first year, 80 of the 93 districts had new U.S. attorneys.
Mm, that's impressive.
Reagan replaced 89 of the 93 districts in his first year. Mm. Yep.
Things have not gotten better because of it.
No,
I guess not. Okay. Well, you certainly don't see those statistics floating around, do you?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, my goodness. So in a nutshell, today, ISIS going back into Iraq upsetting everybody. Everybody's all upset about, okay? So they're under control of Saudi Arabia, who wants to control the oil fields, okay, to make sure that, all that bad old Iraqi oil is not, you know, that's sweet, by the way, it's called sweet oil, okay, because of the low silver content, is not brought onto the market, thus deflating the value of Iraq, of Saudi oil. And also, Steve, one of the things I requested, you know, on your show the other night was, I want to see those pumping records concerning all those refineries that were producing oil when we were there and breaking it down into its constituent components.
Right.
To remember, to be sent to the American people so we didn't have to pay so much to pump, so we could afford to finance the Iraq War. Remember that? Does anybody remember that out there listening now?
Well, certainly,
okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, I remember them, okay, you know, with my mediocre memory. I remember George Bush looking with sincere angst into the camera saying that he was going to try to give the American taxpayer a break, you know, on paying for the war. So that's why we were going to try to lower the cost at the pump. Remember that? Well, I don't remember seeing any sudden drastic dip at the gasoline pump. It stayed high. It went high and stayed high to where, what was it, a year and a half later, George, you know, had that smirky, nasty little sneer that he has on his face all the time. And he tells a National Press Club meeting, he says, look, I would do something about it if I could, but I can't. There's nothing I can do,
right,
you know, to lower the price of, okay, gosh, gee, what a nice guy, okay?
Yep.
And then he turned right around and said that he was going to really do something to help. So he was going to arrange to have oil companies and gas stations pump. When you go in and pay for premium, the gas stations could put in regular in the premium pump, okay? And you've got to pay the cost of premium gasoline. Remember that? And then that smirking little jerk turns around and looks out the audience, of course, all these pacified journalists and photographers, and nobody challenged him. Nobody said a word about that. Well, it's a shame that I wasn't in the audience, okay? Of course, I probably wouldn't be invited back to too many more of these National Press Club, you know, get-togethers. But, you know, by the way, that's where I gave my talk on Abu Ghraib and all the torture going on was at the National Press Club.
Yeah.
Okay, but then George turned right around on the next breath, he turned right around and said, oh, that all the GMO foods like Monsanto and Archer Daniels Midland, who are producing all these grotesquely pathologic artificially grown foods, you know, where DNA manipulation was used, that they did not have to notify the public that they were consuming, okay, that they were consuming these foods, all right? Remember, and that smirking little jerk, okay, and of course, and then you'd always give that, you know, that little challenging sneer to anybody who might have some questions.
Well, sure, they all have that little look. I'm the president.
Okay.
I'm the authority figure here.
Now,
don't challenge me.
Well, no, Steve, since we're all in the free zone, I guess we're in the free speech zone now. We can pretty much say what we want.
Yeah.
Within reason. Okay. Now, isn't George the one who implemented the free speech zone?
Okay? Seems like he was.
Wherever a political speech was given, and you had an opposing opinion, that you had, what was it, miles away?
Yeah,
and it was,
but you also had to...
An enclosed cyclone fencing area?
Yes, but you also had to ask permission to do it too, though, Greg.
Where do these people come from, Steve? Susan, can you tell me, where do these people come from? All right.
I don't know.
They all come from certain bloodline families that have been incestuously unchallenged for many, many decades and many probably hundreds of years, and it all comes down to a brain malformity, I think, and there's some kind of a psychological disease that they all possess, I think.
Well,
I've said for years that we're in the hands of madmen and criminals.
Yeah, somebody else said that too.
Well, look at World War II. Prescott Bush producing Cyclone B. Oh, the Bush family owns the patents for Cyclone B. All right, and how many Jews disappeared? Okay, into the concentration camps, disappeared, and their last breath on Earth that they took was Cyclone B. Okay, when they went into the showers, Cyclone B. Guess who was responsible the very same people that were responsible for sending those weapons of mass destruction that I, when I stood in an underground bunker and pulled off the bills of lading and said that they were responsible for shipping
yeah.
those weapons. Okay. Was anything done to them then?
Yeah.
Oh, gosh. Okay.
I've
got the U.S. Attorney's Office making a joke out of the whole thing right now.
Exactly.
The U.S. Attorney's Office.
Yeah. So, well, look at your clock there, Craig. We're at the hour again.
Oh, okay. Gosh, where's the time fly?
Yeah.
Okay. So,
well, it's been a great time, you guys.
Okay.
Yes,
well,
it has,
to all those folks, you know, in the great UK and Scotland and Ireland, I'll say so long and say good night. Okay. So I'm sure they're just tired, you know, tired of hearing me
and
go on about all this stuff.
It's 2 a.m. over there.
It's fabulous that you have Susan on, Dr. Susan Sill.
Yes.
I'm glad you managed to get her on, as busy as her schedule is. And I look forward to having her come back on so we can hear about the third book.
Well,
okay.
You need to, I asked you a question during the break there, and neither of you give me any kind of an answer, a definitive answer on Sunday.
I would have to look at my schedule.
Schedule, yeah.
Yes.
Okay. All right. Well, gosh, the pressure's on. The pressure's on. Everybody's listening. Okay.
Well, this is going to be a different network, though.
I will look at my daily planner and get back to you on that, Steve. Okay. Well, hopefully we can get a good time where we get the same audience that we had today. Okay.
Well, this is going to be a different audience. This is going to be a different, different network, different audience.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, hopefully it won't be the folks in Crawford, Texas listening. All right.
Yeah.
You know, Crawford, Texas. Okay. Hopefully it won't be those jokers. Okay. So, or wherever Carl Rove lives. So
right.
Anyway, good. We will get back to you, Steve, and thank you, Susan, for coming on the show.
Oh,
yes, thank you very
pleasure,
much, Susan.
And thank you, Greg, and thank you, Steve.
I'm glad you got a little bit of talk time in there, Susan.
I did. I have learned over the years to get word in edgewise with Greg.
Uh-huh. Me too.
Mm-hmm.
I gotta nearly interrupt with him, so I pick my chances wisely.
Oh, cut it out, you guys. Okay. All right. Well, anyway, thanks so much, Steve, and we'll be on your show sometime. Okay.
All right. One more Creedence song to end it here. So, good night, everyone.
Which song is that? Stuck in Lodi?
No. The Midnight Hour. Or do you want Stuck in Lodi?
No, is that Bad Moon? You mean Bad Moon Rising?
No, The Midnight Hour. I've actually got Stuck in Lodi, though.
Oh, The Midnight Hour is by Wilson Pickett. Okay.
Well, that could have been, but Creedence did a song like that, too.
Midnight Hour.
You gotta wait till Midnight Hour.
Right.
I'll go ahead and play a little bit of it for you. I'm going to go ahead and
sing. Well, whatever it is, put it on for you. I'd love to hear it.
All right, everyone. We'll see everyone Friday evening.
Thanks, everyone. Bye.
Will do.